Hello, and welcome to the History of the Early Church. Episode 32, The Upshots of Exile. Last episode, we covered the events following the Decian persecution in the Western Church, particularly Rome and Africa. In this episode, we look at the aftermath of the persecution in the East. Unfortunately, the events in the Eastern Church following the persecution of Decius are less well documented, given that we do not have anything comparable to Cyprian's letters. As a result, this episode will be comparably shorter than the previous. Nonetheless, we do know some things. The end of the persecution was somewhat unexpected for the Eastern Christians, but they wasted no time in picking up the pieces left in the wake of Decius's onslaught. Dionysius of Alexandria resumed his see, Gregory Thaumaturgus and his brethren were able to come back down from the Pontic Hills, both the churches of Antioch and Jerusalem elected successors to their martyred bishops, consecrating Fabius and Mazabanes, respectively. Those who had fled the persecution returned home as confessors for the faith, as did imprisoned believers, who were finally set free. Just as it was in the West, the issue of the lapsed and repentance was of great concern, and different bishops held differing views on the issue. It wasn't long before Novatian's emissaries and letters arrived in the East, which ramped up the problem tenfold. But the attempts of the Novatians to spread their schismatic church in the East were hampered by the powerful Bishop of Alexandria. Dionysius instituted a lenient policy towards the lapsed. He regarded the letters of absolution from the martyrs as valid, and granted forgiveness to any lapsed Christian on their deathbed. He also wrote numerous letters to various Christian communities, encouraging an attitude of mercy towards the repentant lapsed. His communications on the issue reached from his local Egypt to even as far as Armenia. Though many of the details are lost to us, the issue of the lapse in Novatian threatened to divide the Eastern Church, just as it had in the West. For his part, Dionysius of Alexandria was a peace-loving man, and the thought of division in the Church greatly troubled him. He responded to Novatian by writing that if he, Novatian, was truly made Bishop of Rome against his will, he should prove it by voluntarily stepping down. For nothing is worth breaking the Church over. Schism is never justified. Dionysius also wrote a series of letters to the Roman confessors, calling for them to turn away from the path of schism. The decision of the confessors to eventually leave Novatian and join Cornelius may in part be attributable to Dionysius' intervention. Even after their return to the Catholic fold, Dionysius remained in contact with the Roman confessors, as he did with the Roman Church as a whole and its bishops. Despite losing Alexandria, though, the Novatians did receive a welcome ear in the Church of Antioch. Fabius, the new bishop of Antioch, was inclined to side with Novatian, and thus threatened to bring the chief see of Syria into communion with the schismatics. Fabius received letters from both Cornelius of Rome, who presented his side of the story, and Dionysius. Dionysius informed Fabius of the persecution in Alexandria and Egypt, including the pogrom which took place a year before Decius' reign. He also related how the confessors of Egypt had been merciful to the repentant lapsed and extended them the grace of forgiveness. Now, these very confessors were martyrs. How could we, Dionysius asked, set ourselves over the judgment of the holy martyrs and not extend mercy? In addition, Dionysius also told Fabius the story of a lapsed elderly Alexandrian layman named Serapion. Serapion had lived an upright and Christian life, but under Decius he had succumbed and sacrificed. Serapion begged to be restored to communion, but to no avail. As he lay on his deathbed, Serapion asked his young nephew to bring a presbyter to him, so that he may receive communion. The young man found the local presbyter, but could not get him to leave his home because it was night, and the presbyter himself was ill. But the presbyter, in accordance with Dionysius' pastoral policy, granted Serapion readmission. He gave the boy a morsel of the Eucharist, and the young man carried it to his ailing uncle, moistening it and depositing it in Serapion's mouth. Soon after, Serapion expired. Dionysius believed God had preserved him for so long on his deathbed so that he could be restored to the church before his soul departed. We don't know how Fabius responded to Cornelius and Dionysius, but in the end, it mattered little. Not long after, he passed away, and the bishopric of Antioch was passed to Demetrian. Around the same time, the prominent Cilician bishop Helenus of Tarsus was organizing a council to meet in Antioch and settle the novation issue once and for all. Although not well documented, the Council of Antioch in 252-253 was among the largest church councils the Eastern Christians had held up to that point. Among the attendees were Dionysius himself, Origen's disciple Firmilian of Cappadocian Caesarea, Theoctistus of Palestinian Caesarea, Demetrian of Antioch, Mazabanes of Jerusalem, Marinus of Tyre in Phoenicia, and Heliodorus of Syrian Laodicea, along with many other bishops from Syria, Pontus, Bithynia, and Mesopotamia. At the council, the bishops came to the agreement that the rigorism of novation was to be rejected. At least for now, the schism was checked in the East. Though peace was now established within the Eastern churches, it was nowhere close to being established among the Roman-Persian border. The Persian king Shapur invaded Roman Syria, sacking numerous towns and cities, including Antioch itself. It is reported that among the various deportees that were relocated as a result of the sack was none other than Bishop Demetrian himself. Not long after succeeding the controversial Fabius and presiding over a great church council, the Bishop of Antioch found himself and many of his Christian brethren Roman exiles living in the Persian Empire. The upshot of this exile, however, was that Demetrian and his community retained cohesion and strengthened the bond between the Greek-speaking Christians of Roman Syria and the Syriac-speaking Christians of Mesopotamia. Demetrian was even recognized as bishop of the local city of Gundishapur in southwestern Iran. After he died, he was succeeded by one Azdok. Through all this, Demetrian retained his position as bishop of Antioch until his death in 261. The ministry of Demetrian helped form a strong bond between the Persian church and the Antiochian church, a relationship which was to have long-term consequences for Christianity in the Near East. Now, I would be remiss if I did not mention that there is another version to the story of Demetrian. In this version, Demetrian was never exiled to Persia after the sack of Antioch, and the entire story is a pious fiction. Perhaps it was created to strengthen Persian Christian claims to the Church of Antioch. In this telling, Demetrian either died in the sack or survived and continued serving as local bishop down to his death. While the story does have some tendentious elements, many scholars seem quite willing to grant it historicity, and so I don't think it should be simply dismissed. Before we move on, there is one other item worthy of note about the Persian invasion of Roman Syria. In 256, the border city of Dura Europos was sacked by Shapur's forces and then permanently abandoned. Dura Europos has, like the city of Pompeii, which was destroyed by the eruption of Mount Vesuvius, been preserved as a result of its sudden end. And therefore, like Pompeii, it is a gold mine for modern archaeologists. Among the ruins preserved is an ornate and beautiful Christian house church, offering us a rare glimpse to see what a Christian place of worship looked like during this time period. Preserved in the church are wonderful examples of early Christian art and architecture. When we reach the end of the century, we will take a closer look at the Duriropos Church and its ruins. For now, I posted some pictures of it up on the blog site. As the Christians of Antioch were dealing with foreign invasion, the Christians of Cappadocia and Pontus had to do the same. This time, it was the Goths and another barbarian group called the Barani who were doing the invading. Before I proceed, I need to make a correction to the previous episode. I stated that the Gothic invasion Decius died fighting against was the first of many Gothic incursions into the empire during the 3rd century. This is completely untrue, as Gothic raids are attested to in the late 230s and 240s. I even introduced the Goths back in episode 27 when we were still covering Origen. So, sorry about that. Moving on, sometime between 255 and 257, the exact date is not clear, Gothic and Barani barbarians invaded Pontus and Cappadocia, violently ravaging the countryside and terrorizing the locals. The result for the Pontic Church was probably more disastrous than that of the Decian persecution. As bishop of Neo-Caesarea, Gregory Thaumaturgus was confronted with a series of problems and questions arising from the invasion, and in response, he issued an epistle which became known as his canonical letter. So named because in later centuries it would be incorporated into church canon law, and for good reason. In the letter, Gregory demonstrates his integration of biblical exegesis and pragmatism into solid pastorship. Many Christians captured by the barbarians had to eat the food provisions the Goths and Barani offered them. Did this violate Paul's commandment not to eat food sacrificed to idols? After all, the barbarians were pagans. Gregory responded in the negative. These barbarians were not known to sacrifice their meat to idols in the first place, and after all, the Lord had stated it was what came out of the body which defiled, not what went into it. The same logic was applied to Christian women raped by the invaders. Chaste women were utterly blameless, whereas lewd women who had then gone and shacked up with the invaders were to be excluded from communion. Not all the issues faced by Gregory were so easy, however. Some Christians had seized the abandoned property of those taken captive. Some Christians had even taken the opportunity provided by the chaos of the invasion to steal and plunder their neighbors' belongings. Some Christians had committed treason and acted as spies and guides for the Goths and Barani. And finally, some Christians had even joined the invaders themselves in attacking and even killing their neighbors, forgetting or perhaps forsaking their Pontic and Christian allegiance. One would think that the recent imperial persecution would have been enough to weed out these nominal members of the flock, but apparently it was not. These were serious offenses, ranging from theft to outright murder, and the bishop did not take them lightly. But though he laid out steep penalties of excommunication for the offending sinners, Gregory always left open the door of repentance. Through all this, Gregory was able to hold the fledgling Pontic Church together. As historian Robert Grant notes, this may perhaps be the greatest miracle of Gregory the Wonder Worker. Not all the captive Christians taken by the invaders returned, and a good number of them found themselves in exile outside the Roman frontier, just as had the community of Demetrian of Antioch. The upshot of this exile was that these Cappadocian and Pontic Christians mark the beginning of Christianity among the Goths. Though small, this community would grow and lay the first foundation for conversion of the Goths to Christianity. By the early 4th century, These Gothic Christians are even attested as having their own bishop, uniting them structurally with the wider Great Church. Next episode, we will turn our attention back west and see how Cyprian becomes embroiled in new controversies, which ultimately lead to a heated conflict between the Bishop of Carthage and the Bishop of Rome. As always, thank you for listening. If you have questions or feedback about the podcast, you can email me at historyoftheearlychurch@gmail.com. Please don't forget to leave a review on iTunes, post a comment on the Facebook page, facebook.com/earlychurchpodcast, and don't forget to visit the website at historyoftheearlychurch.wordpress.com.